From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, rethinking how we use and conserve water, including what we drink and how we flush our toilets. We talk with Peter Glick, a MacArthur Fellow, editor of the biennial report The World's Water, and co-founder of the Pacific Institute. Also, we talk with Tamara Jenkins about writing and directing The Savages, a new film about two adult siblings who have to move their estranged elderly father to a nursing home now that he has dementia. The film manages to be funny and moving at the same time. It stars Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman as the siblings. Tamara Jenkins also made the film Slums of Beverly Hills. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You might want to put aside your bottled water as you listen to this next interview. It's all about water, including why bottled water is not environmentally correct. My guest is Peter Glick. He's an expert on sustainable water use, the impact of climate change on water, and conflicts over water resources. He edits the biennial report, The World's Water, is a former MacArthur Fellow, and is the founder and president of the think tank, the Pacific Institute, which is based in Oakland. He says it's time to rethink how we use and conserve water. I asked Glick about the areas with the worst water shortages now in the U.S.
Well, we've traditionally thought that the western United States is the place where our water shortages are the worst. After you get west of the Mississippi River, the U.S. starts to dry out. And we really see and have seen for a century scarcity of water, conflict over limited water resources. The entire Southwest, for example, is pretty much dependent on one big river. That's the Colorado River, and it's not all that big. And so there's been conflict over water availability and water scarcity in the West for many, many years. We have a long history of it here. But increasingly, we're finding that we have water problems elsewhere. The entire Southeast right now is in a very, very severe drought. Atlanta is water short. There's a fight between Georgia and Alabama and Florida over water. We see contamination problems throughout the Northeast. I think water is just it's a resource that we can no longer take for granted anywhere. And I think that's going to be one of the new challenges in the coming decades.
Do you think global warming is affecting water supply?
Oh, yes, absolutely. The evidence, first of all, that climate change is a real problem. And second of all, that it's a real problem because of things that humans are doing. And third of all, that it's already happening is increasingly compelling. We just see more and more evidence that climate change is a real problem and that it's going to get much, much worse. And we see a lot of evidence that, in fact, one of the worst impacts of climate change will be impacts on our water supply, water availability, water quality, water temperature, water timing and distribution, the frequency and intensity of droughts and floods. All of those things are connected to climate.
So you see more drought and more flooding?
Yes, ironically. Climate change could have, I guess, caused a better world. It could have made the drier places become wetter and the wetter places become a little bit drier and cold places warmer. But unfortunately, the more we learn about climate change and the more we learn about what the impacts of climate change are going to be, the more bad news we get. It seems as though the drier places are going to get drier just because of the way the world's climate system delivers water. It doesn't deliver water particularly well to dry places. And as the climate changes, that may be worsened. And at the same time, of course, we worry terribly about floods, a tremendous amount of water in a short period of time. And it seems as though the climate cycle is going to intensify. That is, we're going to get more rain where we already get a lot of rain, and it may be condensed into a shorter period of time. So we may unfortunately get both more droughts and more floods. It's sort of the worst of all possible worlds.
Hey, thanks for the good news. Now, one of your major points is that we have to stop thinking about water in the way that we thought about it in the 20th century. The emphasis in the 20th century was on what?
Well, in the 20th century, we built, especially in the United States, but this is true worldwide, we built a tremendous amount of physical infrastructure. We built dams to capture water in the wet season so we could use it in the dry season. We built reservoirs and aqueducts so that we could move water from where we get it to where we want it, from wet places to dry places. And that infrastructure, that hard path, as I've described it, brought enormous advantages to us, enormous benefits to us. It was a wonderful thing. We eliminated water-related diseases in this country, pretty much. We used to suffer terribly in the United States from cholera and dysentery and typhoid and all of those diseases that we associated with lack of safe drinking water. And mostly those completely disappeared in the early part of the 19th century and the later part of the 19th century when we built that infrastructure. But the opportunities to build new dams and new reservoirs is pretty much gone. We've built on the good dam sites and unfortunately some of the bad dam sites as well. And we're going to have to rethink the way we use the existing resources we have. There may be places to build new infrastructure, But I actually think the 21st century is going to be, in the United States especially, a century of water management and smart use and rethinking allocations of water from one user to another and figuring out how to use the infrastructure we built better.
One of the more surprising things I learned in reading about you is that although we're having a water crisis in parts of the United States, we actually use less water per person and less water in total than we did 25 years ago. I find that kind of shocking.
It's shocking, perhaps not just to you, but interestingly enough, to many people who work in the water area. The fundamental assumption that we train our engineers and we train our hydrologists and we train our water managers to assume is that as population grows and our economy grows, the demand for water must inexorably also grow. And in the past, that's been pretty much true. As our population, as our economy grew, the demand, our withdrawals of water grew as well, exponentially, up until, interestingly enough, around the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then those two curves split apart. And today, in the United States, we actually use less water for everything, for drinking, for cleaning, for flushing our toilets, for irrigation, for cooling our power plants, than we used 20 years ago. And per person, we use a lot less water than we used 20 years ago. We broke that link. And even today, most water planners don't know that. And they continue to assume, and this is part of this 20th century mentality that I think has to change, they continue to assume that a healthy economy and a growing population means we have to tap more and more into our, frankly, limited water resource.
What accounts for the fact that we're using less water per person than we used to?
In the 1980s, we had an energy crisis. Actually, in the late 70s, we had a series of energy crises. And we also had a series of environmental crises. I don't know if you recall, but the Cuyahoga River caught fire in the late 1960s. Lake Erie was dying. Water pollution was horrible in the United States because we had no controls whatsoever on the kinds of things we put in our wastewater, and we dumped them into our rivers and streams without really consideration for the environment. That was a time when we passed our first national environmental laws. We passed the Clean Water Act, and we passed the Safe Drinking Water Act. And one piece of that required industry to, for the first time, not dump untreated wastewater into our rivers and streams. And it turns out that one of the best ways to cut down on wastewater is to simply use less water in the first place. Rather than produce a lot of wastewater and treat it, which is very expensive, if you can figure out how to produce less wastewater, then you save money and you meet these federal standards that are very important to us. That was the first reason that industry started to look at ways to save water, to use water more effectively. And let me give you actually a good example. In the 1930s in the U.S., it took 200 tons of water to make a ton of steel. By the 1980s, the steel industry had gotten that down to about 20 tons of water to make a ton of steel, partly because they were trying to figure out how to meet these wastewater rules. Today, the most efficient steel plants in the world use only 3 or 4 tons of water to make a ton of steel. That's a 98-99% reduction in the water requirement to make steel. And that's part of what's going on in this trend toward water use efficiency. We're getting smarter at doing what we want to do and figuring out how to do it with less water.
Do you feel like individuals are getting smarter, too, and using water in their homes and offices?
I do. If you think about how we use water in our homes, it turns out the largest single user of water in our homes is our toilets. And before 1994, almost all the toilets sold in the United States used 6 gallons every time we flushed them. And more than a decade ago, in 1994, the federal government changed the standard to 1.6 gallons per flush. And that's a 75% reduction just in the amount of water to flush toilets. But we've also improved our shower heads. Our front-loading washing machines are much more water efficient than they used to be, than the old top-loading washing machines. Basically, all of the forms of appliances that use water are more efficient today than they used to be. And You know, heaven knows there's still plenty of horrible, inefficient toilets and washing machines and showerheads out there. And that's actually a good thing in that it offers us some opportunities to improve our efficiency even more. But we're becoming more efficient. We're doing what we want with less water.
If we've cut back on water per person, why are we experiencing a shortage of water? Why is it more of a problem than it was, say, 25 years ago?
There are a couple of reasons for that. One is nature gives us water in different times and different places in different amounts. And the southeastern United States is in a very severe drought right now, as is the southwestern United States. So there are times when nature just doesn't give us very much. So I would say our concerns about water scarcity are a combination of natural variability, a combination of the fact that climate change is increasingly putting pressure on our water and water scarce areas, and on the fact that our populations have grown in places where water is very short. And so the little bit of slack that we might have had in dry areas like the Southwest is gone. We've over-allocated the rivers that are there. We've given away more water than nature is going in the long run to reliably provide for us.
My guest is Peter Glick, the co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute. We'll talk more about rethinking water use and conservation after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Glick. He's the co-founder and president of the Pacific Institute, which is a research and policy think tank. He's an expert on water issues. Now, a lot of people are drinking bottled water. There's the big gallon jugs, and then there's the little bottles that people walk around drinking. You don't really like the idea of bottled water. What's the problem with it?
Well, I don't really like the idea of bottled water. I love the idea that in the United States, we can get high-quality potable water from our taps for incredibly low cost. That fact is the reason why we don't have water-related diseases in the United States, which are so rampant still in much of the rest of the world. We invested 100 years ago in our municipal water systems, and we invested in high-quality tap water. And I worry about bottled water and the perception that our tap water isn't good. A perception that is unfortunately often encouraged by advertising for bottled water. I worry about the energy cost of bottling water. I worry about the plastics involved in bottled water. I understand completely that bottled water is very convenient. There are times when I will admit to buying bottled water when I have no other choice, something my friends are probably going to be horrified to hear. But it's a luxury, and it's a luxury we don't really need for the most part. I'm not saying we shouldn't have bottled water, but I really do believe people ought to understand what, first of all, high-quality tap water is available to them, and second of all, what the true costs of bottled water are.
Well, let's talk about those true costs. Am I right in saying it takes 3 liters of water to produce 1 liter of bottled water?
Well, interestingly, it takes 3 liters of water to produce the plastic bottle that holds a liter of bottled water.
Oh, I see.
Bottled water, of course, mostly comes in plastic in the United States, PET plastic, which is recyclable, although rarely recycled. And it takes a lot of energy, and it takes a lot of water to make the plastic itself. So probably if you include the liter of water that's in the bottle, it probably takes 3 to 4 liters of water to make a liter of bottled water.
How much oil does it take?
Well, we actually estimated this, not including the energy to cool the bottle in the store or to move the bottle from the bottling plant to where it's sold, just the energy involved in making the plastic and in actually bottling the water itself. We estimated was the equivalent of about 17 million barrels of oil a year in the United States for the 8 billion gallons of bottled water that we drink every year.
You've pointed out that we don't need potable water to flush toilets or to water lawns. So what kind of alternatives do you see? How would we be able to use non-drinkable water for things like watering lawns or flushing toilets?
Yeah, that's a great point and a very important idea. Again, in the 20th century, we built this water system, and it brings incredibly high-quality potable water to our homes. And we use it to drink and to flush our toilets and to water our lawns. It's a crazy use of a wonderful resource. And so one of the things that people are thinking about in the coming years is ways of using non-potable water for non-potable purposes. In new homes, for example, increasingly we're seeing homes that are what are called dual-plumbed. They have two sets of pipes. One brings high-quality potable water to our faucets, and the other brings fairly high-quality but not necessarily potable water, sometimes treated wastewater, to flush our toilets and to use on our lawns where we don't need potable water. It's expensive to do in homes that are already plumbed, but it's not as expensive to do in new developments where we have access to two different sources of water. We're going to see more and more of that. We're going to see more and more use of treated wastewater on golf courses for industrial uses that don't require potable drinking water. I think figuring out how to match the quality of the water that we have with the quality of water in the different uses that we need is part of this new thinking for the 21st century.
What do you think about desalinization, taking seawater, using a process that gets the salt out of it so it can be drinkable and used for other purposes?
It's ironic that we live on a planet that seems to be covered in water, to be talking about water problems. And 98% of the water on the planet is salt water. It's the salt water in the oceans. And for centuries, we've looked at that water and we've thought, if only we could figure out how to make that salt water fresh, then our problems would be solved. And the truth is, we know how to make that salt water fresh water. It's called desalination or desalinization or desalting. There are many technologies that have been used for decades now to make fresh water out of salt, But the challenge is still that it's very, very expensive. It takes a lot of energy to strip salt ions out of salt water. And the energy costs alone make the price of desalinated water way beyond anything farmers would be able to afford, for example. So I think that we're going to see more and more desalination. I think we're already seeing it expanding fairly rapidly in places that don't have any alternative and have a lot of energy, like the Persian Gulf, for example. But in the United States, we still have less costly alternatives. It's less costly to use water that we already pay for more efficiently. It's less costly to figure out how to use water more effectively in agriculture and send some of that water to the cities. We are seeing a little bit of desalination. There's a new plant in Florida, in Tampa Bay. There are proposals for plants in California for very high-valued municipal uses. So I do think we will see desalination in the United States, but I think it will be a relatively small part of the solution for some time to come.
You've consulted to a lot of cities, and you did an analysis of Las Vegas's water problem. Las Vegas is a desert town with a booming population and a lot of water problems. I'm wondering, you know, you made your recommendations and everything, but I'm wondering if you think that places like Las Vegas should exist in the first place. You know, if you think there should be booming cities and places that are hard to sustain in terms of water because they're in a desert.
Well,
not that they asked you and it's a little too late, but
yeah, if they had asked me, I might have made a recommendation in that regard, but it's too late. We have built our cities in the desert. We've assumed that we could do whatever we want and we'll find the water. We'll move the water there. This is the way Las Vegas was developed. It was the way Los Angeles was developed, Phoenix, Tucson. We built cities in the desert. I don't know why people love to live in really hot, dry places, but they do. And in the past, the answer has been build it and we'll figure out a way to get the water there. And that worked to some degree in the 20th century, but it's not going to work in the 21st century. There isn't any more water. We're at our limits. We're at the limits of our resources here, and we're not going to go to Canada or Alaska We're not going to desalinate seawater infinitely and move it to Las Vegas. It's too far and too expensive. And so the idea that we can grow without thinking about the resources that are available for that growth is an old idea, and it's not going to work any longer. It's time that we integrated the concept of growth and concerns about growth with decisions about water and frankly, energy and all of the other resources that we use. We can't grow infinitely without running up against limits. And in places like Las Vegas, those limits are pretty apparent already.
Well, Peter Glick, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me, Terry.
Peter Glick is the president of the Pacific Institute in Oakland and edits the biennial report, The World's Water. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble and the Barnes & Noble Review, the new online literary magazine with reviews, interviews, and recommendations. From 20th Century Fox Home Entertainment, presenting The Namesake, a vibrant coming-of-age story starring Cal Penn, on DVD today. And from Abrams Image, publisher of Plato and a Platypus Walk into a Bar, Understanding Philosophy Through Jokes by Thomas Cathcart and Daniel Klein. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a new film about the complicated and sometimes maddening relationship between adult children and their elderly ailing parents. We talk with Tamara Jenkins about writing and directing The Savages, starring Philip Seymour Hoffman and Laura Linney as siblings who move their father to a nursing home after he develops dementia. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie, The Savages, is about an experience a lot of people go through, uprooting their own lives to take care of elderly, sick parents. My guest Tamara Jenkins wrote and directed the film. She also made Slums of Beverly Hills. In The Savages, Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman star as Wendy and John Savage, siblings who have just found out their estranged father has dementia and needs care. So Wendy leaves her cramped Greenwich Village apartment, John leaves his home in Buffalo, New York, and they meet in Sun City, Arizona, where their father has lived in a retirement community. He'd been living with his girlfriend, who paid for their home, but she's just died and left him nothing. Wendy and John take their father to a nursing home in Buffalo and try to figure out how to care for a father who didn't do a very good job taking care of them. Let's hear a scene from the movie. Wendy thinks the Buffalo nursing home they've put their father in is run down and depressing. At her insistence, they take their father to a more upscale nursing home to apply for admission. During the screening process, Wendy makes it seem as if her father is mentally more with it than he really is. Right after that, Wendy and John are outside arguing.
What'd you say to them?
I said he was pretty good, except he goes in and out every once in a while.
In and out? Wendy, the man's got dementia.
I know, but they only had beds for people who were more independent. I thought if we could just get him in there.
Why are you wasting our time on fantasies?
She said she would put him on one of the waiting lists. I mean, Jesus, I'm just doing it for Dad.
Dad's not the one that has a problem with the Valley View.
No, I'm just trying to improve the situation. Is that a crime?
There's nothing wrong with Dad's situation. Dad's situation is fine, but he's never going to adjust to it if we keep yanking him out of there. All right, and actually, this upward mobility fixation of yours, it's counterproductive and frankly pretty selfish.
Selfish?
Yeah, because it's not about Dad. It's about you, you and your guilt. That's what these places prey upon.
I happen to think it's nicer here. Well,
of course you do. Because you're the consumer they want to target. You're the guilty demographic. The landscaping, the neighborhoods of care, they're not for the residents, they're for the relatives. People like you and me who don't want to admit to what's really going on here.
Which is what, John?
People are dying, Wendy. Right inside that beautiful building right now, it's a f***ing horror show.
Tamara Jenkins, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's a pleasure to have you on the show. Love the film.
Oh, thank you.
Now, your previous film, Slums of Beverly Hills, was based on your experiences growing up with a father who was a gambler and a drifter and tried to find the cheapest place in the Beverly Hills zip code so that you could go to a good public school. And I figure The Savages is based, a little bit at least, on your father, too, because in our 1998 interview, when we were talking about Slums of Beverly Hills, in talking about your father, you described memories that are so close to the movie. And I had to ask myself, like, back in 1998, when these stories were in front of your mind and you were talking about them, did you have any idea that they would be related to your next film?
What did I say?
You talked about how
was I talking?
Uh-huh. You talked about how your father had been living with a woman, and basically she was paying for everything. And
uh-huh.
then she got sick, and she died, and that your father had dementia, and you had to take him on a plane.
I can't even believe we talked about
yeah.
this. That is so unnerving.
And that you had to take him from a plane from the retirement community
yes.
to
well, it wasn't
living
a retirement
or the nursing
community.
Home,
yeah.
or from wherever he was living
yeah.
with her.
Uh huh. Uh huh. I mean, what I've been in describing the movie and. I've been differentiating from it being strictly autobiographical versus it being really personal. Because if I said it was entirely autobiographical, I'd end up like that guy James Fry, who you know wrote that book and you know showed up on Oprah and he defined it as a memoir, and then he was got in a lot of trouble because he had freely fictionalized, apparently. So this movie is. There's a lot of fiction, but the heart of the story is based on my personal experience with actually two family members, my grandmother and my father, who both were in nursing homes at the end of their life and both suffered from dementia. So in that aspect, there's a kind of personal autobiographical core, but I definitely take liberties as a, you know, dramatist.
You know, I was telling a friend about your movie, The Savages, and I said something like, well, it's a movie about two adult children who are kind of estranged from each other, who get together to take care of the father they're kind of estranged from, who now has dementia and has to be taken to a nursing home.
And
and it's really funny. And they looked at me, they were so puzzled. And I thought, like, when you sat down and knew you were making a comedy, uh-huh. and it's not like a slapstick comedy, but I mean, there's parts of it that are just like really funny. How do you figure out where the humor is in such a really sad situation?
I mean, I guess a couple things. I think it's a sort of sensibility that is kind of part of my DNA or the way that I see, and I don't really separate. I mean, the world separates comedies from tragedies and, you know, dramas from farces. But I actually think that if you are paying close attention in life, that you'll see that they actually are operating in stereo most of the time. If you kind of look underneath, you know, if you look under the tablecloth or look through the curtains, or, you know, if you're sort of attentive, you can kind of hear under tragedy is a kind of human farce happening also.
One of the scenes in the movie that I really love, and I think anybody who's had like a parent really sick in the hospital will recognize this moment. You walk into the hospital room and you don't know what to expect. You don't know what your parent is going to look like. And you walk in and you see your parent lying there with the oxygen and the IV, the urine bag with the fluids dripping into it. The TV's on, but nobody's listening or watching. And it's just this like horrible sinking feeling. And you just like visually capture that so perfectly. Can you talk a little bit about like shooting in a hospital and shooting that scene and what you wanted to show?
Well, we actually, at the beginning of the film, spent a lot of time in sort of abandoned hospitals that we obviously, you know, fixed up and production designed to make them look like they were functioning. But we did have a lot of days, and we were clocking in many hours in abandoned hospitals and nursing homes. Or actually, I guess the nursing home that we used was a tiny little hospital that we then set decorated and made appear like a nursing home. So those are pretty bleak environments. They're not very glamorous locations. but it certainly sort of set the tone for the milieu of this movie. And in terms of the alienating, I mean, all those details that you just described, you know, the television sort of blaring into a room where the person's not even awake, or and that sort of alienation is, you know, something that I think anybody who's ever spent time in a hospital, you know, with a parent or themselves probably recognizes those sort of details. But they had sort of multiple layers of alienation. One is that they'd been sort of estranged from this father. But even when they were with the father, there was a kind of, you know, estrangement, an emotional neglect and an emotional estrangement. And then on top of it, there was this third layer of, you know, this dementia that was setting in. So there was a lot of layers of disconnection.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins, the writer and director of the new film, The Savages. Here's the scene we were just talking about. Wendy and John, played by Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman, are visiting their father in the hospital for the first time. His hands are in restraints to prevent him from pulling out his IV. The father is played by Philip Bosco.
Where have you been?
Hi, Dad.
Hi, Dad. How are you?
How are you?
They have me hug tight for 2 days.
We got here as soon as we could. We came straight from the airport. It's John and Wendy.
I know who you are. The late ones. You're late. You weren't here, and this is what they do. See?
Dad.
You weren't here, I said.
John, go get
nobody.
Somebody.
Dad, we weren't here because we live on the East Coast, remember?
Yeah.
We haven't seen you in a long time, and we're here to help you.
So do something. You're the doctor.
I'm going to go get some money.
He's not that kind of doctor, Dad. He's a professor.
I thought my boy was a doctor.
Doctor of philosophy. PhD. Teaches college.
Medicine?
No. Drama. Teaches theater.
Like Broadway?
No, like theater of social unrest. Stuff like that.
We'll talk more with Tamara Jenkins about her movie The Savages after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film, The Savages. It stars Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman as siblings who put their elderly father in a nursing home after he develops dementia. One of the things the daughter has to do is fly with her father from Sun City, where he'd been living in a retirement community, to Buffalo, New York, where her brother teaches. And, you know, she's taking him to a nursing home in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know from our previous interview that you flew with your father to assisted living or nursing home. I'm not sure which.
Right.
But what was your experience like flying with him on the plane? And how incapacitated was he at that point when you were flying with him? Like, that's such a difficult thing to do. And I think it's something so many people have faced. Making it a really difficult trip. Yeah.
And it's kind of almost this, invisible thing until you've had the experience. I don't think you quite. And now anytime I'm on an airplane and I feel like I see it all the time now. Like suddenly my, eyes, I've woken up and I see that it's actually happening around me. And, sort of the difficulty of travel with an elderly person, either being accompanied by a family member or not. But that is definitely something that I had that I sort of ripped out of my own experience. And I think that I didn't quite, as, Wendy doesn't quite understand the complexity of the task at hand. Besides the emotional impact of, what she's doing, I don't think she even realizes sort of the physical burden of transporting someone who kind of can't take care of themselves. And I think the sort of gravity of that becomes more and more clear.
When your father had dementia, were there certain things that were like essential, deep parts of his personality that became more pronounced, even if they were different during his dementia period than they were before?
With both of my family members who suffered from dementia, it almost felt like, sometimes it felt like an amplification of them in this, like the volume sort of being turned up on aspects of their personality that might have been slightly more buried. It was very heightened, but it didn't feel unfamiliar, their behavior. But it was sort of at this high pitch.
And what was it for your father? Which qualities?
I think it was a kind of volatility that was always there that just seemed louder and more. The swings of it were sort of really strong and striking. But he was always sort of that sort of person, he would swing from moods, and suddenly it would happen quite quickly and a sort of a loud volume. And also that sort of interesting thing about someone with dementia where they're sort of retreat, and you feel like they're not present, and then they will just wow you with some zinger. Like, you didn't even know they were there. You didn't know that they were present. And then some, almost like a punchline comes flying through the night, and you can't believe it. So my father was actually really funny, and sometimes out of the blackness of dementia, he'd just say something and slay you.
Well, you cast Philip Bosco to play the father, and he's really terrific in the role. A very kind of crusty, sometimes bitter, and sometimes just, like, really, really sad. I guess I'm curious what the audition was like, whether you just kind of said you got the role or whether there was an audition.
There was an audition, and I was very concerned about the casting of the part, and it was very important to me that he wasn't trivialized, that the character wasn't trivialized as a bastard with a twinkle in his eye. I just didn't want that cutification that I think often occurs with difficult old men, where mm-hmm. there's some sentimental streak in which either the author or the actor or a director or a combination of factors lead to some cute factor that, just to make him sympathetic, to make the medicine go down. It just felt like that would be a disaster, and I wanted it to be very honest and blunt. And so I was reading people, and my casting director, Jeannie McCarthy, suggested Phil Bosco, and I was being a really dumb, literal director person, and I was thinking, oh, Phil Bosco, he plays judges and, kind of well-heeled patriarchs, and he does Shaw, and he's too fancy. Anyway, in walks Phil Bosco, and he sat down in our little room, very small room where we were reading people, and he read with my casting director, and it was the scene in the diner where the kids ask him if, you know, dad, you know, what would happen if you were in a coma? He says, what the hell kind of question is that? It's, you know, the place, the Valley View, they need it for their records. You know, what the hell kind of hotel is it? Dad, it's not a hotel. It's a nursing home. So he was reading the scene, and when Jeannie, who was playing opposite him, kind of, you know, reads the line, Dad, it's, you know, not a hotel, it's a nursing home. I think inside that pause, the way he was sort of absorbing that information was quite beautiful and stunning. And he wasn't, you know, cloying for he wasn't begging for sympathy. He was just blunt and tough and just playing it so truthfully and so straight. I really was kind of nuts for him. And I very unprofessionally leapt up and hugged him after his audition. And he kind of straightened himself up and started heading towards the door. And I think that he became very suspicious of what kind of movie is this. Directors don't usually leap up and hug people after readings. And he turned around on his way out, and he, just to make sure that it wasn't some fly-by-night operation, he said, so Laura Linney and Philip Seymour Hoffman, they're attached to be in this, right? I think he thought, and I said, no, really, really, I swear, this is very professional. but I think he was suspicious, rightly so.
Well, I love that scene because, you know, as you say, he doesn't, like, play it for pathos or sympathy or anything. By the end of the scene, he's yelling at the two kids that they're idiots, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great scene. Why don't I play it?
Dad, we need to talk about a couple things.
But we don't want you to take it in the wrong way.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just... It's a couple questions that'll make everything easier in the long run.
Okay. In the event that something should happen, How do you want us to,
Dad, what if you're in a coma?
John.
Would you want a breathing machine to keep you alive?
What kind of question is that?
Well, it's a question we should know, in case.
In case what?
In case something happens.
Nothing's gonna happen. Right now, nothing new.
Right, it's this procedure. It's something they want for their records.
Who?
The people who run the place, the Valley View.
What the hell kind of hotel is it?
Dad, it's not a hotel. It's a nursing home.
Unplug me.
What?
Pull the plug!
And that's Philip Seymour Hoffman, Laura Linney, and Philip Bosco in a scene from the new film The Savages, and Savage is the last name of the family. And my guest, Tamara Jenkins, is the writer and director of the film. She also made Slums of Beverly Hills. The children in your story, they're both writers. She's writing a semi-autobiographical play, or as she describes it, a subversive semi-autobiographical play. He's writing a book about Brecht, and their father just isn't like a book kind of guy. And you realize that there's probably a lot of things that they would never be able to really share. And I guess I'm interested in hearing why you wanted to create that kind of relationship on screen where the children's lives are so different from the parents. There's so much, even if he wasn't suffering from dementia, they wouldn't get about each other.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that has to do with what we were talking about before in terms of the estrangement being, you know, extra doubled up. And I mean, I feel like it's something I've seen, you know, in many relationships between parents and children, a kind of almost like foreignness, like, who are you? What have I wrought? And in my own experience, you know, I have three brothers who are professors, and I think that actually in my family, they're you know, none of my parents were educated, and no one went to college, let alone having, you know, gone out and gotten PhDs and teaching at universities. So it was certainly something that I was familiar with, that sort of estranged, you know, just feeling like, you know, that you were from different planets to a certain extent. But I know that I'm not alone in that. I mean, I think that even, you know, parents and children that have more in common can often feel that their offspring or their parent, that nobody knows where the other person came from.
My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film, The Savages. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tamara Jenkins. She wrote and directed the new film The Savages, about two adult siblings who put their elderly father in a nursing home.
If this isn't too personal, I'm wondering what your father's funeral was like.
In real life?
Yeah.
It was intimate. It was in Philadelphia, which is where I was born and where he was born.
And he once had a strip club, right?
Where he once had a strip club, yes. You're so well-researched. But yes, and so it was, you know, our family was there and some extended family was there. And it was quite intimate and actually in this beautiful little cemetery, which now I can't remember the name of, but it's right in the middle of the city. It was, and it was quite, I remember it being very overcast and it was like this idyllic little cemetery. It was quite lovely. I wish I could remember the name of the cemetery. I know I have it at home, but you know, it was very moving.
You know, in the scene in the diner that we played from The Savages,
yes.
The children ask their father. They can't figure out how to ask him exactly, but they finally get around to asking, like, so, do you want life support, and what happens after you die? Did you know what your father's wishes were for a funeral? If he wanted to be buried or cremated, if he you know, like what kind of funeral
he wanted? We knew that he wanted to be buried. And he was also in World War II. So, you know, there was a flag over the casket because he was a sergeant in World War II. So there was a veterans element to the proceedings. And it was a plot near other family members. So he knew where he was going. He held on to that paperwork for a long time.
Do you have children?
No.
The reason why I ask is, knowing that you had a kind of challenged relationship with your father, that you were estranged for a long time, and that, you know, to judge from the movie, from both of your movies, he wasn't a traditional parent, wasn't traditional in his parenting style. For some people, that would make them really want to become a parent and feel like, I'm going to do it right. You know,
right.
And others would say, like, you know, families are difficult. I think I'll stay away from having one of my own.
Right.
And I guess I'm curious how it affected you and your choices.
I'm married and we're actually pursuing a family, but we're definitely on the late side of that. we'll be older parents. But, you know, I do think that it can create a delay or, you know, a rejection. But in my case, I certainly haven't rejected parenthood, and it's something that I'm actively pursuing. And but, you know, I didn't get married until I was 40. So I'm sort of on the slow boat approach to maturation, but I'm planning on it.
And your husband, I should mention, is Jim Taylor, who is a screenwriting partner with Alexander Payne, and they work together on About Schmidt and Sideways. Did you have like a film meeting? You know, like, did you meet through film?
We actually had a kind of a cute meet, as they say in the old-time movie business about romantic comedies. But our cute meet was I went to NYU Graduate Film School, and when I was leaving NYU Graduate Film School, Jim Taylor was entering, and he has said that the reason that he went to NYU Film School, or one of the reasons, was that they had shown my short films. You know, they'll show people's past work and as an example of the kind of work that's coming out of the program. And so his story is that he fell in love with my shorts first, and then we met, and then he liked me. But for some reason, his name is Jim Taylor, so I never would remember his name. And he said that he tried to introduce himself to me over the course of 10 years, and every time he introduced himself to me, that I would never remember who he was. But obviously, now I remember because we're married.
When did he finally make an impression on you?
I guess it was like 7 years ago or something. We re-met on a subway car heading up. I was on my way to Lincoln Center to see a movie. It was a Friday night, and I was going to see Come and See by Klimov. A very bleak movie, a great, great film. And he was on the subway, and he was on, I said, where are you going? And he said that he was on his way to his shrink. And I thought, oh my God, this guy's going to a shrink on a Friday night. He's very interesting. He's perfect for me. I was impressed.
Well, congratulations on the movie, and I hope now that you're married that your husband isn't spending more Friday nights at the shrink.
No, now we're in couples therapy, so it's all working out quite well.
Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tamara Jenkins wrote and directed the new film, The Savages. It opens in select cities tomorrow. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from Dial Press Trade Paperbacks, publisher of the new paperback editions of Felice and Forms of Shelter by Angela Davis Gardner. From the Annenberg Foundation, advancing public well-being through improved communication, on the web at annenbergfoundation.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Sharon Jones and the Dap Kings, a band inspired by soul and funk bands of the 60s and 70s. Join us for the next Fresh Air.